Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast about cave exploration. A lot of us do it for fun. A lot of us do it to explore, discover, to research, to challenge ourselves, but it almost always starts out as fun. So if you haven't gone before and you're interested, I would encourage you to do it, but only if you do it right. There are countless stories out there about people who go caving or what some people call spelunking unprepared. Not enough lights, no helmet, no map, not enough people in your group. And when you do that, anything that goes wrong could potentially be a disaster waiting to happen. So what I'm saying is do it. Go have fun, but learn how to do it right. And the best way to do that is to join a grotto. That's a local chapter of the NSS, the National Speleological Society. And you can find the nearest grotto by going to the NSS website, caves.org. There you can also join the NSS, which right now is about $40 a year for a digital membership. That's what I have. That'll give you access to all kinds of cool stuff like the online bookstore where you can buy books with maps and other great cave info. Grotto memberships are cheap, too. And you'll meet a lot of cool people who also like to go caving. So welcome to caving. We want more cavers, but we all need to know what we're doing. My guest this month is former NSS President Bill Tozer. More on that in a minute. Want to thank our sponsor this month, Swago. Swagos are back. One of the best cave packs in existence. One of the only packs out there that are waterproof. And they're back on the market. You recall they went out of production a couple of years ago because the material supply dried up. But since then, Scott has looked and looked and did some test packs with different material and finally settled on something that was comparable to the original packs. I think it's better. And now he's back in business. Swago packs come in three sizes, and the medium size, the pit pack, is currently sold out on the website. But he's making more. Or you might want to check with Intermountain Outfitters, who's currently selling the new Swago packs. But Scott came to Indiana Cave Capers last month to officially reintroduce Swago packs, and we were truly honored to be involved with that. He had some free posters to give away, too. That was cool. I even donated a couple of packs for our raffle in the NCRC silent auction. Anyway, I was amazed to find out that the size of pack that he uses most often, almost exclusively, is the push pack, the smallest one. He uses that on his long survey trips. He and I went out to dinner on Friday night at Capers, and we got to talking, and I told him to name all the items in his pack on a typical survey trip, and he starts rattling off all these things I didn't think he could possibly fit in that little pack. He got about halfway through the list, and I'm like, the pack's full, right? He's like, no, and he kept going. But you know, I guess you just have to know how to pack it. Anyway, if you want one, that small one, which, again, is more than enough for Scott, the founder of Swago, is only $129. Each size up, add $10. Get them at swagogear.com or from Intermountain Outfitters. Swago! I love my Swago, Scott, and thanks for the pizza Friday night. Also, I want a push pack. Let's talk. Speaking of Indiana Cave Capers, what a huge success that was this year. If you've never been up to Indiana for Cave Capers, make plans to come next year. You missed a great one this year, but next year we're going to try to capture that same magic, I guess. I don't know. It was just such a great group. Decent weather. It was a little iffy there for a while, and we probably would have had more people come if the weather had just looked better the week before, but we really lucked out. Had well over 200 people in attendance. A good year for Indiana Cave Capers is when we just barely scraped that mark. So to surpass that by a lot was really, really special and really helpful to our grotto. And walking around the party Friday night and going caving Saturday, I was really humbled to find out how many people had come so far and who had come all the way up from Tag and other farther flung places. And a few of the people that I talked to had come just because of the podcast. And it was great talking to everybody. If I talked to you at all that weekend, just know that I had a really wonderful time hanging out. You really made my weekend, and the support for the caving community felt really strong. I got to lead a great trip to Salt's Cave, had a lot of out-of-towners on that trip. Great cave, great group, had a blast, had fun destroying some Mexican food after with all of you. Hope to go caving with you again soon if you were on my trip. So thanks if you were there. Make plans to come next year, first weekend in August. Crawford County Fairgrounds 2019. Oh, real quick, I want to mention OTR is this weekend. And if you're going, look for Charlie, an organic robot, one of my other sponsors. He'll be selling t-shirts. One of the best caving-related t-shirt makers out there, and talk him up. He's a great dude. I understand he's going to try to bring his printer and print shirts on site, so you may be able to get some custom work from him. I don't know. Say hi to Charlie at OTR and pick up some shirts. Okay, Bill Tozer lives in Colorado now, was a longtime member of my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, chairman a few times, other board positions, helped organize several Indiana cave capers, made his way into national leadership, became president of the NSS from 2005 to 2008. He shares some great caving stories, great commentary on the NSS, and some of his accomplishments. I mean, he's a humble guy, which you'll hear, but some of the stuff that he's done is just fantastic, like being one of the first people down Fantastic Pit in Ellison's Cave. Also, one of the first people to do Golondrinas down in Mexico, what some people know as the Cave of the Swallows. That's the one that you see people base jumping into at the beginning of Planet Earth. Can't do that anymore, but you can still rappel at it if you get the right permissions and follow the rules. He tells a great story about that experience, doing it in the mid-60s on 1,200 feet of gold line climbing rope. And if you know anything about gold line, you know how that's probably going to turn out. Just some great stuff. That's a great story. So let's get to it. Here is Bill Tozer.
Do you have your NSS number off the top of your head?
Yes, I do. 4955.
Okay. Good deal. Your first cave, then?
My very first cave?
Yeah.
Grotto Cave, right down in near Bloomington, Garrison Chapel.
Yeah. We had a group go there just a few weeks ago.
It's a neat cave.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's why I got hooked. It was interesting. I kind of got started in this because a couple of friends, high school friends, had gone caving with some people from Rose Holman. That was Jack Derry and Bugs Armstrong was in that group. But anyway, they said, "Oh, this is neat. You ought to go to this cave and see what it's like." And I said, "Oh, we need a car." I said, "Well, I got my dad's car." So we hopped in the car and drove down there, fired up the old carbide lights, rigged a rope down the slope and went down a little drop and through the crawl and into this big borehole, as you recall.
Yeah.
And then they said, "Well, every time we come to this cave, we find something new." And so they looked under this ledge, and they said, "Let's go under here." And Max went to the left. Bob went straight ahead, and they said, "Bill, you go to the right." I took a look over there, and it was 6 feet away was a wall. I mean, just, I said, "Yeah, right." But I crawled over there anyway, and then I found a vertical crack. And I went up in that crack, and it went into a dome. And I From then on, I was hooked.
Because you found something.
Yeah, that's right. It was exciting, you know.
So where'd you go after that? Did you stick around Garrison Chapel Valley down near Bloomington, or did you kind of go all over?
Oh, well, I guess I should tell you the rest of the story.
Yeah, all right.
You see, I got home, and I put my pile of caving clothes at the end of the bed. And the next morning, my father came in to wake me up to go to work, and he says, "What happened? Did you fall in a ditch or something?" I said, "No. We went spelunking." He says, "Oh, hell, what's spelunking?" I said, "Well, we went into a cave." He didn't say anything else. And then I got up and got dressed and went out to the kitchen, and he turned around to me and said, "Bill, your mother and I have discussed this. You're not going in any more caves."
Oh, no. So, well, we all know how that turned out, but how did that turn out in the moment?
Well, as a good son, I obeyed their wishes until I started college, and then I started saying to them, "Well, you know, I'm old enough to make decisions. You don't understand. It's not as dangerous as you think." So
their issue was the danger, not the mud you're tracking into the house.
No. So they allowed me to go, but they said, "We don't approve." I just kept coming back, so they decided, "Well, maybe it's all right."
So the first cave was 1959?
Yeah, right.
Grotto Cave was 1959. So you said you took a break after that at your parents' wishes. How long was the break?
Well, perhaps a year or so.
Okay, so it wasn't that long, but it was long enough.
While I was in college, we went and did some caving.
Yeah.
And in the early days, I had visited the grotto, both the BIG and the CIG, but more or less visit, come back, and Didn't join the CIG until about 1963.
So you were caving just kind of for fun, not necessarily organized, for a couple of years before you joined an organized group?
Right, for about 3 to 4 years.
Were you doing anything serious in that 3 or 4 years, like project caving, or were you just going caving, having fun?
We were going caving and having fun. I mean, that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what, during that fun time, and you've done a lot of official stuff since then, but during that fun time, where were you going? Where did you frequent? Or did you try to go to a different cave every time?
Well, we tried different caves. Mostly we're in the Garrison Chapel. We went over to Buckner's and we did Freeman's Pit.
Oh, boy.
That's also an interesting story because, again, this was in early 60s.
For the listeners who may not be familiar with the area, Freeman Pit is about just shy of 100 feet, just a pit.
Right.
And so what was your equipment like back in the early 60s?
Well, we used half-inch manila. So this guy, a friend of mine, again, from Brazil, has said, come on, I'll show you. Let's go do this pit. And we go over there, and he throws this half-inch manila rope into the pit, and then he whips out this carabiner, and he takes a loop of just a diaper sling type of thing, and he clips a beaner on that, and he runs the main rope through that and over your shoulder. And he says, you see how I did this? Yeah. Yeah. And so then he rappels to the bottom.
Oh, goodness.
So then he ties the loop and the beaner onto the rope. We pull it up, and I rig it up in the same way as he did. I said, well, I guess this looks right. So I started over, and I had no padding on my shoulder. So the next thing I knew, I was hunched over because of the stress, you know, on the rope on the shoulder. And we get to the bottom, and my other friend was there. He also went down. And then the experienced guy, that means he really had been one or two times, he says, well, I'm going to show you how to get out. And so he tied 3 prusik knots on. He says, you see, it's one in the chest, one in each leg. And, yeah, we see it. Pretty simple knot. So he climbs out, throws the loops down, says, okay, it's your turn. Well, needless to say, we made it out.
Well, yeah.
And
you're here.
I would not recommend anybody learning to do vertical work that way.
Well, I guess trial by fire is one way to do it. Goodness gracious.
Yes. Well, I'm glad we all survived.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. So then you started doing organized caving in the early to mid 60s through the CIG, you say?
Right.
Joined the CIG.
Right.
Which is my grotto, a grotto with a rich 65, 70 year history.
Yes.
And so once you started doing the organized caving, I'm sure that the seriousness picked up. You started surveying, started discovering things like that.
I'll tell you, before we start on that, I'd like to mention that we went to our first NSS convention, which was in Mountain Lake, Virginia, in 1963.
Yeah.
And we'd done single rope climbing techniques, you know, for some time. So we wanted to go to Clover Hollow, which is a very well-known cave in the West Virginia. But anyway, it has a 70-foot pit entrance, and then there's back in the cave, there's another 100-foot. Well, we had enough rope to do the 70, but when we didn't have rope for the other, I met Bill Cuddington. First time. You know, he was a famous vertical caver.
Vertical Bill.
And we were just nobody. You know, we're just young guys and no reputation, nobody really knew who we were.
Sure.
But we got talking to him. He says, well, I'll lend you a rope, which is just his personality.
Yeah.
We went in and did the pit. We got back there, dropped the 100-foot pit, joined by 2 CIG cavers. That was Mike Wishmeyer and Jay Arnold. And both of them and I were at the bottom of this 100-foot pit. I said, well, it's time to get out. And Jay says, well, you know, I've never climbed in a cave before. I've been on cliffs, but... And then Mike Wishmeyer, who is another famous CIG caver associated with Sullivan Cave, said, well, he hadn't climbed either. I said, well, there's only one thing to do. We got to climb out.
We got to climb out anyway, so I guess you're learning.
And so we all did. It kind of shows how things started.
Yeah.
Whereas today, you know, we got to take you out to a cliff somewhere and or a gym and do some climbing and learn how to do it right.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you and those guys, I mean, you were kind of the guys who figured it out and saw better and better gear. I mean, you did stuff then that was, you know, really more or less safe, but not as safe as the stuff that we can do now. But you kind of broke that ground.
Correct.
And I mean, I can speak for my generation about how much we appreciate that.
Part of the story that we did, that I did, we lived through was the development of equipment and climbing techniques and now lights. We went and discovered brick bars. And so we would rig a double brick bar. Well, you know, that really saved the shoulder.
Yeah.
And made it a lot easier.
No more body repels.
Right. Right. And then we also did mostly three-knot climbing with Prusiks. We didn't really discover Jumars, which until we went to Surprise Pit. Because we, again, we were people who thought, you know, you could do anything. So we'd heard about Surprise Pit, and the Alabama cavers were hiking over the ridge, walking, and they had discovered the cave, and the water flows in it, and they went in it, and it goes down, you know, over 400 feet. So they said, well, we got to have somebody go down here. And the only way they would do that, the only person they knew that could go that far was Bill Cuddington. So they called him down there, and he lowered a lantern. He still tells the story. They lowered the lantern till they thought the rope reached the bottom, and they had to tie two ropes together. Well, Bill went over the knot, got to the bottom, looked around, then came out. Well, what we did, when all of this we kind of heard about, and so we said, well, we can do this. We weren't icons. We were just cavers, you know, young guys who think they can do anything. So we went down there to visit that cave, and we went over Christmas holidays. During that time, we met Bob Clark, who was an Alabama caver, and he said, well, it's too wet to do Surprise now. Come back in August. So we did do Engle Double and Natural Well, which are over 200 feet mm-hmm. in each of those. But come August, we were back down there, and then we did it. As I said, we were among the first 10 people to set foot on the bottom.
Wow.
And it was that time when we had, in the first trip in Alabama, that we discovered Jumars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you said Surprise is around 400?
It's over 400.
Over 400?
It depends on the rig point. Well, where we were at, it's like 420 or something like that.
Yeah. I've not done Surprise, so I'm not terribly familiar. But, yeah, you kind of want Jumars for that. But you did a lot with knots, though.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I still do, actually.
Really? You prefer knots?
Well, no.
To a degree?
I use the Mitchell system.
Okay.
All which right, is two Jumars, and I was fortunate to know Dick Mitchell personally at an Alabama convention, I think. They always had the flat climbing contest, you know, for distance. So I had done it with at the Sarah conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was the first time that they did it on the national convention. And so I went there, and this is my bragging point. I was the first person to be under 2 minutes for the 100 meter.
Good then for
Dick,
you.
Then Dick Mitchell got on the line with his new climbing system, and climbed in like 37 seconds or something like that. So put me in my place, but I was second.
Showed you up. Well, I mean, had he not shown up, you would have been the winner.
That's correct.
So you made a few discoveries, a lot of them in Indiana. What did you find in Indiana that's big news?
Well, there were really, the first project we looked at was a Henderson Park. There was a CIG grotto trip down there and to the park. And if you recall, there's Mill Cave, Middle Cave, and Waterfall Cave. Well, they went into Middle, and it's a walk-in entrance, but then it turns, and there's a little water crawl, little crawl in a little bit of water into a big room, which is wall-to-wall water. And there's a waterfall. Well, Dan Chase had climbed that on that CIG trip and walked a little ways and says, hey, there's a lot of cave here, and it goes. But that's all they did. So several of us got together as kind of a CIG project and went down and surveyed the passage, found a second waterfall above that, and also Mill Cave and a waterfall. Mill Cave is interesting because for those who haven't been there, it's, again, a walk-in passage, you wade water up to about your knees, and it finally comes to a room with a big breakdown blocking the further passage. I'm sure there's cave, but nobody's found it yet, or at least. But if you go up and backtrack, it really, the passage follows along the surface of the lower passage. I mean, it follows the lower passage. And we, if you wind it around, it comes to a little room, and then there's a tube, which is about the size of a 2 feet in diameter circular. And if you belly crawl through that, you pop into another walking passage. And if you follow that walking passage, which we did, and we were surveying, we surveyed all the way down to the end of it where it sumps. Well, we didn't realize it, but when we got back home and started plotting it out, it just made a loop, and we came back to within 70 feet of the original entrance. And that was kind of a fun thing. Of course, and then we also surveyed the waterfall cave, and actually we found a second entrance to it in the back, but it's since been closed off, so you can't get in. But also Middle Cave, as I said, we found a second waterfall, and then if you go back to eventually the passage pinches out.
So that kind of gave you the discovery bug then.
That gave us a project thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which really then, we call ourselves the Hendersoners, and we then said, well, we got to find another project, which was Wildcat Cave in Orange County. So we went down there and we surveyed that. The cave has been known for a long time. But we surveyed that, and really there was no drain that we could find that you could get into. But just up the river is Riverside Cave. And so we went over there and decided to survey that passage, that cave, back to the direction of Wildcat. The cave, really, if Riverside Cave has a very large room. You walk in the entrance, you're down in a slope, and there's a big room. And water flows out of the left wall and flows into the right. The right goes, you can't get through it. But the left one, you can hands and knees through water. And then 20 feet or so, and you pop up into another room 40 feet high. And so then it was, again, a CIG survey trip. We went in and surveyed into through the crawl and then back to in the passage. The passage, the ceiling remains pretty much the same. But the floor keeps rising. So we had surveyed quite a bit and then piqued our interest, and we started surveying a lot of it. We surveyed, oh, maybe two or three trips to the Y room. That's spelled W-H-Y. Because there's 1,000 foot of crawlway, some of it belly, lots of it hands and knees in water.
Why?
Yeah, why? When you get back there, there's two ways to go. Well, one way is impassable. But the other way is pretty near impassable.
Yeah.
And we had kind of looked in there and said, well, we'll do that another time. So a following trip was, I wasn't on the trip. I couldn't make it. That went into the cave, and they got clear back to the Y room.
Right.
They kind of tried to crawl through this thing and said, nah, I can't do it. And Lynn says, I'm going to push it. And he pushed it, and he went through again. Maybe 20 feet of this belly crawl, and then pops up into passive walking passage, and maybe 1,000 foot of cave back there.
Wow!
So on that discovery trip, they came back out and they were in the Y room again, sitting there, kind of saying, "Boy, wish Tozer was here. We really found something." And then all of a sudden, Lynn said, "Well, there's water pouring in here." They started kidding him about blocking up the passage, except he wasn't blocking up the passage. It had rained significantly, and it was starting to flood.
Oh.
And they took off for the entrance, as I said, a couple thousand feet before they could get to that room. And, of course, by the time they got there, that exit crawlway was flooded.
Wow.
So they climbed up on a ledge. And
so they'd waded out.
That's right. They, you know, let's say maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon or evening, they realized they could this happened, and they waited until like mid-morning the next day.
Oh, my gosh.
So before the water finally got low enough that they could get out, I was tasked with sitting on the outside, comforting the families and saying, I know they're in that room. They're perfectly safe. And they were, but they spent a few hours extra in there, in the cave.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so it was a 20-plus hour thing, but they were, wow, goodness gracious. Scary, then. Was it?
Yeah. Glenn LeMasters was the fourth one.
Glenn LeMasters. Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, Glenn tells about how they wore out the mud bank walking back and forth trying to keep warm. And that's kind of interesting. By the way, that is written up by Lynn in the CIG newsletter. So if you're really interested, you can look back and
I got my DVD archive right over here.
Yeah,
I'll have to find that. That would be what year?
I think it would be in the early 80s.
Early 80s, okay.
To be honest, I would have to check to be sure.
All right, well, I'll look for it. That's interesting.
It is.
Well, so going back a little ways, were you one of the Sullivaneers?
No, actually, I wasn't. I'd been in Sullivan a long time, and I knew Mike Wischmeyer, who was the pusher, the head guy, you know. He was actually a student of mine when I was teaching in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And but anyway, they went – I knew several old guys because they were CIGers, and they went in and stayed, you know, for 2 weeks, and then they actually did it again. So did the psychological testing before, and they went in, stayed underground.
I heard about all that from a number of people, but Dick Blend's on the podcast, and that was interesting that they did that, that they took it that far, that they did the psychological testing and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah.
One other early experience I had was going into Wayne Cave when they were having the expedition that was staying underground.
Yeah, yeah. Bugs Armstrong very involved in that too.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he was there and several others. But so we came down, and to get into Wayne Cave, you just lifted this metal grate across the entrance, but it was only put there because they wanted to keep people from coming in while they were in the cave.
Sure.
But we went through the crawlway and to Camp 1 and then went into the RPI Discovery. And I remember that passage was covered with gypsum flowers. I mean, it was everywhere. So you were kind of squeezing together to hold your hands together and very carefully going through that passage.
Yeah, yeah.
If you've been through there now, it's not there.
No, no, they're not. But it's still beautiful, but it's definitely been traveled.
Right. There is gypsum down in the cracks, if you look for it. And also the moon milk was pretty spectacular then. You understand that was at the time that they were discovered, the domes, and the moon milk was really proficient in a lot of it, and it was very, very white. So that's another thing that is aged.
It's still the trip to take if you're going to Wayne.
Absolutely.
To go to RPI, but it's definitely not at all what it used to be from what I hear. I mean, I've only known it in the modern era.
Right.
But
think of the thousands of people that have gone in there.
Yeah. So you were one of the first to do Golondrinus, right?
Right. We had heard that they'd found the pit.
Yeah.
And Cuttington, and there were several others that went in on that first expedition. I think we were like the third group that went. And again, it was cavers from Indiana. It was Jay Arnold and Lee Lawton and Steve Klein and myself. And Norm Kettering went along. It was nice to have him because he was a captain in the Army Intelligence Service. And he said, well, if we get in trouble, all I got to do is call the embassy and they'll take us all out. And me and everybody with me. But we didn't have that. Fortunately, didn't have that. Norm stayed on top to watch the rope, guard the rope.
Yeah. You got to have that.
Right. We bought 1,200 foot of gold line. Now, gold line is a laid climbing rope, which means that if you hang a weight on it, you spin, and it also stretches a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Up to that point, they had used Samson 2-in-1, which is a core rope with a sheath. And the only thing bad about it is it abrades badly. So if it rubs on a rock at all, it'll just cut that sheath in half. And it's been, some people have experienced the sheath sliding down the rope,
ooh,
which is not fun.
No.
I mean, you don't go off the end because it jams up, but it's not fun falling 2 or 3 feet. Anyway, we selected to use gold line because we wanted to take it back. We were going to cut it up among everybody and then take it back and go tag caving, which, you know, there's a lot of rocks and we wanted an abrasion resistant rope.
Yeah.
So we did the gold line. Well, everybody said you cannot do a 1,000 foot, 1,200 foot pit on, it's actually 1,087, I think.
Yeah. 1,100 thereabouts.
Yeah. On gold line because the spin will kill you. Well,
oh, no.
We took a vote and I won. Oh, no, maybe I lost. I don't know. I had to go first. And so we rigged a 1,200 foot rope and we rigged a short rope so that you could switch ropes and climb up.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, you started down.
What were you descending with? Were you doing brake bars on carabiners, or were you what were you using at the time?
I think I was using a rack at that point.
Okay. This was 60 what?
This was 67.
67.
I was in Mexico in 65 with John Cole was and Bill Cunnington and Dan Hale and I. And John Cole had the rack. That's when he first made one.
Yeah.
And so I made one. Actually, I went down to the shop department and said, look, can you make one like this? And they said, sure. So, I mean, it was a metal shop, you know, and they made this rack for me. I actually made a couple of them.
Made
so
a
that's,
rack.
That's what, yeah. That's before they
before they made them. Yeah, yeah.
It's I mean, just incredible. John was making them by taking a charcoal grill, you know.
Oh, wow.
And then he'd take a hairdryer to blow air into it to make it hot enough so that he could bend the steel. So anyway, that's that's how he made the first racks. Well, anyway, he showed me one, and so then I went back to school and had one made, and bought the brake bars, put on, and that's what I used in Golden Drinas.
Wow!
So, to kind of an interesting experience because when you start over, it's bright sunlight. So when you look down, you see nothing but black, and until you get down a little ways, that you can actually see the bottom. And I would look down, and I would see these rocks, and they were looked like small boulders until I got closer, and they started being the size of a car, you know, because of the distance.
Yeah.
So I went down, and then Steve Klein was the second guy down. And then the next guy was Jay Arnold, and he came down. Then Steve and I were climbing tandem out. You know, I was on top. So I said, Steve, just stay here. I'll take out some of the stretch. So I'd climb, and I climbed up a whole long way before I got my feet off the ground.
Right.
And then I finally climbed up about 80 feet, and I said this, and during this was spinning.
You're spinning the whole time.
Spinning at about 25 revolutions per minute.
Oh, my goodness.
By their timing.
Goodness.
And the only way to keep from getting sick was to stare at the Jumars right in front of you. Well, I climbed up about 80 feet, and I said, okay, Steve, go ahead and get on. He was using knots. I was using Jumars. And anyway, he climbed up with the knots, and as soon as he started going and climbing, he pulled me back down to the bottom almost.
Oh, my goodness.
I was within about 20 feet. And I said, stop.
That much
and I
stretch.
Climbed some more. So he,
that much stretch.
Oh, unbelievable.
Gracious.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's why they've developed ropes further, you know.
Well, now, at what point, because you got 1,100 feet to climb up, but at what point did it stop spinning? Did it?
Well,
at all?
Actually, the more you climb, the slower it came. But
sure.
I would say it was about 200 feet you were kind of up. You were in a slow spin. But it was slow. It was slow. I mean, you know, it wasn't bad at all.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, I would climb, and Steve was climbing with nuts, and so we'd climb up a ways, and I'd look over to the side, and I'd say, okay, there's a spot over there. I see a formation, so, you know, a rock strata. And so then I'd climb like crazy, and I'd look over, and the strata was still there in the same place because it was so far away. You're right in the middle of this thing, you know, 400 feet from the wall. So it was really – the only way you could tell you were climbing is if you watched the rope go by your Jumars.
But even then, you're kind of wigged out because you were stretching it so much when you got on it to start to climb. You think, am I making any progress at all?
Yeah, well, we knew there was going to be stretch. We also were worried about the spin.
Yeah.
That was a missed thing. People in Texas, which we the Mexican cavers, said, you know, this is crazy. I wish you luck. Yeah. And but we had our reasons, and we thought we could do it, so we did. And we climbed, as I said, about, we climbed all the way. I don't know how much additional mileage I got at
the
bottom.
So with Golden Drinas then, did you just go to the bottom, go to the, you know, the main floor and then climb back out? Or did you ever descend that, what do they call it, the crack?
There is a crack and a climb. We looked into it. We walked all the way around, and it's a huge thing. Lee washed the rope. When it was time to come out, he had to look for the rope because, you know, he couldn't find it.
Yeah, it's a huge room.
It is a very large room. And we looked in the crack. It went down But we didn't go down it.
Hmm.
I understand they've since then they've gone down it and have found a little bit of passage. We didn't go down it.
Okay, yeah.
So we were thought, when we got to the bottom, we thought, hey, we've done it. Because
yeah.
even though the hardest part was yet to come, you had to do that.
Yeah.
So we went up. Steve and I climbed all the way out. In the meantime, then, when we got to the top, Lee Lawton rappelled to the bottom. And then he and Jay looked around a little bit, and they started to climb out. And Jay was on top, and Lee would climb with him. He got about, oh, I understand, 200 feet off the bottom and got terribly sick.
Oh, no.
Lee had a motion sickness problem.
Yeah.
And so he went back to the bottom, took some Dramamine, and kind of got his bearings and felt good, and then he started climbing out. Well, in the meantime, Jay climbed out to the top. And we were thinking, well, what about Lee?
Yeah.
We were actually thinking we would have to rappel back down to get him.
Oh.
But we could hear him climbing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we just waited, and with time, he made it. So
I can't believe he rappelled back down to lose all that gain, you know?
I know, but he was really sick, I guess.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Then we started hiking out because, you know, with the burros. At that time, you had to walk all the way back to Akeshman.
Well, and you'd been there, for how long? I mean, it takes, 2-3 hours to climb out? I mean, especially with knots and early...
Yeah, it took us 2 hours.
Took you 2 hours, okay.
But we started walking out, and all we were doing was talking about how people could do the goal line on a deep drop like this. And then when we get to the Akeshman, the Heffy, the sheriff, shows up and says, well, don't touch anything in the car. We're going to have to search your stuff. And so there we were in the middle of the town square with hundreds of people, it seemed like, surrounding us, of the locals wanting to watch a show while the Heffy, the president, would searching through all of our gear looking for gold.
Oh,
gold.
Gold.
I said, yeah, this is gold. This is this rope. So.
Oh, man. Well, and so you were one of the first 10 people to do, what was it?
Fantastic
Pit.
Yes.
So were you part of the discovery crew for that, or were you, you heard about it? And
well.
That's amazing.
At that time, there were probably a handful of really competent vertical cavers, and one of them was Richard Schreiber, who's well known for his discoveries. And he had found the cave. It was actually what they do is Ellison Cave. You had to walk long way through a little bit of water. It was a stoop way, and then you come to the agony and ecstasy, and that's when it opens up, and you can actually walk to the first nuisance drop, and then there's a I think it's 70 feet or so, and then you get to the pit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Richard found this on a ridge walk, and he found the pit. And he said, well, call up my friends, and I fortunately was a friend. He called me up and says, well, we found a deep pit down in Georgia. Are you interested in coming down? I said, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So Jay and I went down there, and when we went into the cave at the top of the pit, just when Richard and that discovery crew were coming out. They said, we don't know how deep it is, but the rope reaches the bottom. But so we went in and did the pit, and then at the bottom, it's a very large pit, and you're pretty much free the whole way. And then when you get to the bottom, there's some passageway, what led eventually to the passage that then connected to Incredible Dome.
Yeah.
Jay and I had looked in there, but everybody was saying, you know, we got to get out. And we didn't. We looked up there, and we said, well, it looks like it might be, but it didn't look like much, so we didn't go in it. So we went out and climbed out of the pit on that Samson rope. Every time I'd come to one of these abraded places, I'd say, whew, I'm glad I'm past this one. Of course, Jay was underneath me, and he says, will you quit talking? So anyway, we made it out of there and had a good time.
Man, I bet.
But again, it's because of who you know, right? And I mean, I had been caving with all these guys, and I knew them, and so we were naturally call our friends.
Yeah. Well, so how many times have you? We'll start with Ellison's. Like, how many times have you frequented Ellison's? But have you ever been back to Golondrinus since then?
No, I have not returned.
Just one Golden Arenas trip.
Right.
Been there, done that. Okay.
Sarno was discovered, which is a little deeper, but it's like a big, wide hole.
Yeah, it's like it's like almost like a valley with a wall.
Right. You're climbing down a cliff, essentially, a repelling cliff. So that wasn't appealing, I guess. Plus, my family, I have four children, and they were at the age when I wasn't able to be free to just go and do everything I wanted to do. So.
Yeah, yeah. I'm there right now.
Okay. When they get older, though, you can take them caving.
I can't wait. I can't wait. So so Ellison's, I mean, how often did you go back there? Because there's plenty to see there.
Just twice. I've been there twice.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right.
And we were always trying to find new stuff. And again, as I said, the family was coming into play, and long weekends were not as good.
Yeah, not as easy to do at that time.
Correct.
You later got involved in, grotto leadership, specifically with the Central Indiana Grotto.
Right.
You've been chairman. You've held other office positions, and you helped to organize Cave Capers. I mean, what was that like for you? Did that just come naturally? Was that just a passion, just a drive for you?
Well, I joined in 63. Grotto, and elections came up that fall, and Tom Ray says, well, you ought to run, just as a board member.
Yeah.
But in the process.
That's how they get you.
Yeah, and then you get on. But I was chairman in 65, I think, which was the first Indiana convention, NSS convention. And I became chairman the next year. And then what I did, basically, is I served a year or two, and then I would get somebody else to run. I'd say, you should do this. But I say, I'll support you and help you put on Cave Capers. So I was involved in putting on Cave Capers in the 60s, and I did the same thing in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
Goodness.
Actually, I mean, not every convention, of course.
Sure, not every single one. But
right, but there would be somebody that would be involved in it. I left Indiana in 1970 to take a job at an observatory, Dudley Observatory in Albany, New York. And so I was gone for 4 years. When I came back, the grotto was in one of those low cycles when there weren't very many people at the meetings and things were going poorly in terms of the grotto. Bill Waymire stepped in and kind of took over the leadership at that time and encouraged people to go. He also owned Cave River Valley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so we had capers at Cave River Valley, and of course, no cost because it was his thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, he did a lot to get things going, and it's during that period, which was like the latter part of the 70s, I was chairman again. And I was also newsletter editor for 13 years.
Well, and then this translated to national leadership as well. I mean, you were NSS president in the mid-2000s, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always felt I was a caver, and I was not interested in that politics. I mean, the grotto was different. You know, those are all cavers.
Yeah, yeah. And those
which
are
you deal with and you go caving with.
Yeah.
Right. So, I thought, well, I'll just run for the Board of Governors and as a director. And first time I ran, I lost by 60 ballots. And then, so I said, okay, I'll try it one more year. And I won by 60 ballots. both people were friends. But anyway, I served on the NSS as a director on the board for 2 terms, 6 years.
Yeah.
And enjoyed it immensely because I would, they would have meetings throughout the country. Convention meeting and then 2 meetings, one in the fall, one in the spring, wherever. And so as a result, I got to visit all of these areas, which I would not necessarily go to. And I made it a point always to take an extra day to go caving. So not only did I get to go caving in lots of places,
yeah,
I got to meet a lot of neat people. So.
Well, absolutely.
So it was a good experience. Then I laid out for a year and then ran for president and served that for 3 years.
Yeah, 05 to 08 then?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
So what about after that? Did you kind of take a break from the national spotlight after that? Had you had enough at that point, or did you kind of stick around a little bit?
Well, as a director, I thought I knew what the officers did.
Yeah.
But when I got to be president, I really learned there was a tremendous amount of time and effort. I mean, like a full-time job.
Yeah.
In terms of time.
That you're not getting paid for.
No. And it cost me to, I have to pay the convention registration. I have to pay the travel to the meetings.
Yeah.
So it cost me. But I tell you, it was a good experience. And I would encourage anybody to thank all the officers because of all the effort and time that they put into the NSS. It's just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, and I'm the chairman of the CIG currently, and I couldn't do it without the rest of the guys that not only who are on the board, but the guys who come to the meetings. I have to reference Keith Dunlap, who's sitting in the room here, just hanging out. But because it really is a team effort, and when it is a team effort, is the only way it works.
Absolutely. Just to follow up, you asked what I've done since.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still active in the fact that I do some caving, and I have continued to, since I know all those people that are on the board, or most of them anyway, interact with them, tell them, you know, my historical advice, or hysterical, whichever you want to call it. But anyway, I tell them about things that were done and why they were done, and sometimes you need that perspective to really make good decisions.
Well, and speaking of things that were done, I mean, when you were there, you kind of helped to initiate the new headquarters, right?
Correct. That was interesting because up to that point, we had the old headquarters, and our museum and our cave files were here in Indiana with Blends.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the memorabilia was scattered in Virginia in somebody's barn. And so we said, well, we ought to have a place. And it was suggested that we take the White House, which is a house across the street from the headquarters, the old headquarters,
yeah,
and which was being used as storage. And I said, well, look, let's do it right. And so I asked the board, I said, look, let's explore this. But I says, I do not want to appoint a committee that's going to just make a report and it'll be filed. Yeah. I said, tell me that you're serious and that you really want to do something.
We don't want to mire this in compromise and committee speak and think.
Right. And so they passed that motion, and then we proceeded, put out a call for bids. One of them was from Kentucky around Mammoth Cave. One of them was from Huntsville. And one of them was from Indiana.
Oh.
Blend's property was offered because he was willing to donate the property. But so all three of them
had to build something. It would have been a whole thing.
Correct.
So I understand why he didn't.
We'd have the same thing in Mammoth. And we had the same thing in Huntsville. We would have to. You choose. Do you buy something and remodel it, or do you build something new? Well, we ended up buying something and remodeling it in Huntsville. But to be honest, there was a lot of dissension because of the different groups. We finally established that it was going to be in Huntsville, and we bought that property, and we raised the money to buy it. And it's almost paid off as of today.
And it's something that can make the organization money to be rented out and whatnot.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's more or less financially sustainable.
Right. And as you
less
know,
of a liability that way.
Yeah, there's some 90 acres with a couple of small caves on it, but it had a nice room, and we could rent that out. And they're doing that to kind of pay for some of the upkeep, because, you know, with a property, you have all the maintenance, and you have staff, employees. We only have like 2 employees in the NSS, and that's another thing to I'd like to comment about. The NSS functions because of the volunteers. It's money, it's time, it's interests in all facets, really.
Mm-hmm.
They are what make the NSS what it is. And you hear other people talk about it, what they do, and they cannot believe what we do as a society with people.
Yeah, because it's all volunteer.
All volunteer.
It's all volunteer. I mean, with the exception of a few paid staffers, 2 paid staffers who don't really make that much, the rest is all volunteer. The leadership and everything else, it's all volunteer.
Yes.
So when it comes to complaining about it, you better be willing to back that up with some volunteer hours and whatnot before you can open your mouth about some of that stuff, right?
Yes, right. That's kind of how I got to be editor. I complained because the current editor wasn't putting it out, you know. And I said, well, you know, we really need this for the Grotto to have a newsletter. They said, well, are you willing to do it?
That's the fastest way to get a job. Complain about how it's going in the first place.
yeah, I guess.
Oh, that's fantastic. Any other caving stories you'd care to share?
Well, there was a third project that we did, and that was Charles Cave.
Mm.
That was kind of myself and George Bruchin and a couple of people. Charles Cave, we found Charles Cave. It's got a big entrance, and you walk into it, and a stream flows out from under a ledge, and there's a wall of dirt. And I said, well, I mean clay, you know. So I said, well, we could just dig through here around this sump. So we dug, and we'd go back to the grotto, and I'd say, well, we had a good trip. We dug 10 feet or whatever. And
yeah, yeah.
I'd say, but the next one, we're going to break through. And we'd go, I'd get some volunteers. We'd go down there and dig some more.
10 more feet.
Yeah, 10 more feet. And then one day, we went there. And the sump was open.
Oh!
So we got down in the water. You know, it's one of those ear dippers, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So you're up against the ceiling with your mouth, and we go through it, and it opens up and extends into a great cave system. We since gave up the digging. But, you know, it could be there. It could be more passage, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Well, so, they say that about a lot of follies in Indiana, as it were. There's a lot of folly passages.
Yes.
A lot of Armstrong's folly is in a few caves, actually.
Yeah, he kept digging a long way, and if you just dig 10 more feet, you're going to be in that other branch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So anyway, in the Charles Cave, Keith was Dunlap was part of it, and Glenn LeMasters and George Bruchin and myself were the principals. There were some other people that were involved in smaller parts, but we went and mapped the whole thing, and I forget the exact mileage, but it was several miles of cave, three miles of cave,
yeah,
that we found, including a very difficult back entrance, but wasn't in the water.
Where is Charles Cave?
Washington County.
Washington County. All right. Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that earlier before we turned the microphones on. Washington County. Not a ton of caves there, but the ones that are there are pretty cool.
Right. A lot of them have water in them.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the digging trips down there, we come out of the cave and start to walk back, and this guy walks into from the woods, and he says, you guys have permission? Well, no, we thought it was okay.
Yeah.
And it turned out he was the owner, and ooh, it was a furniture company was using the wood in there. But I felt one of my attributes was cave owner relations, and so I started talking to him, and finally he came around and he let us go up there whenever we wanted. And so I just contacted him and say, hey, we're going to go down to the cave, and he was really interested in what we were finding.
You know, so.
But
you got to have that guy in the group who can talk to the owners.
Right. Absolutely.
You've got to have that person, and they've got to be good. You can't just designate them. You got to figure out who it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, who can sweet talk?
One of my first trips, he and I went to Truett's Cave, IU Cave, and at the cave, we walked up there, and I let him do the talking, and he said to the owner, we were greeted by the guy with a shotgun and a dog, and he says, we understand there's a cave here. We'd like to explore it. We're cave explorers. And the guy says, there ain't no cave explorers around here. Now get.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
So that didn't turn out too well. Then.
No. Okay. No, I've never been to IU Truett Cave yet. But it's surprising. When you talk to them, the owners, and don't be pushy, but just kind of talk to them and let them know that you're okay.
Yeah.
They'll let you do things.
And try not to get that crazy caver glimmer in your eye. Try to act like a normal person.
Right. Hey, I'm interested in protecting your property. I'm interested in safety. We're not going to do anything that's going to be dangerous. And if you talk to them a while, they start to believe you.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing, and it's again a suggestion to the grottos, and I know it's happening, is one of the things that we did was to take school groups and church groups caving. I mean, we always chose the cave where they could not damage the cave. You know, somebody, someplace like Buckner's or Sullivan's.
Yeah.
And I found that there, some of the kids that went thought that was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
But they didn't go any further. I mean, I told them about the grotto. Some of them joined the grotto, including Dean Meyer, who was very active in the grotto. And then I've had some where this one young lady got out of the cave and she says, boy, I'm glad I did this, but I'm never going to do it again.
One of the best first-time caver quotes I ever heard was from my sister-in-law, who said, I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting this.
Yeah.
But that's great. Yeah, I mean, I've heard that too. This was great, but I'm never coming back.
Yeah, I'm sure glad I did this because I got a story to tell. And even some of the students that I've had, I see them and they always remember, oh, I remember that cave we went to. Yeah. And they don't remember any of the physics I taught them, but they remember the cave.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, outreach is very important. I mean, and it's great when you've got a few people in the grotto who are always willing to take new people. I'm thinking immediately of Paul Uglum in the CIG, who is always willing to take first-timers. And big groups of scouts and whatnot. I've taken big scout groups and that's fun if you can corral them all, if you've got enough of their dads there to keep everything straight. And it is just fun. And some of them take a real liking to it. And that's all you're trying to do with that. You're trying to find people who might just have this bug in them.
Correct. Yeah. You know, I moved to Colorado because my daughter and grandkids moved out there. Mm. But and it's a nice place with lots of outdoor activities.
Absolutely.
Too. But I've gone to three grottos, and I tell all of them that the CIG does three things that are really good. One of them.
I hope we're still doing them.
Yeah. Well, you are, I think. One of them is having a monthly grotto trip, which is open. People can go to. I mean, you choose your caves, sure. And you get somebody that's willing to do it, which is sometimes hard, I know. Back then and even now, maybe, but a grotto trip, because then people would show up and say, well, what's caving about? And they would get a chance to go caving.
With cavers.
Well yes.
Which is important.
Where you could teach them about safety, conservation, and so on. And the second thing that is communications. And I really feel strongly that a newsletter is important.
Mm-hmm.
Because a monthly one tells about activities, it tells about what the grotto is doing. It tells about trips that are coming or programs. It keeps people involved, and I think that's really a great thing. The third thing is just the ability to talk to newcomers and make them feel like they're at home. I mean, I probably experienced it and maybe even contributed. When you go to a grotto meeting, an important thing was the social aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seeing your fellow cavers and, well, what are you doing? And here's what we're planning, et cetera, or whatever. And so you tend to break apart and talk to the people that you go caving with,
mm-hmm.
which some people would call a clique, but which is, there's nothing wrong with it. But don't forget that there are other people out here who are not in the clique, mm-hmm. that just showed up, and make sure that to talk to them, you know, mm-hmm. not just say hello. Glad you're here. Goodbye.
It's certainly what kept me coming back,
right.
were these people who I later found out, you know, were going all the time, and I wanted to know about this stuff, and they were the ones who were coming up and talking to me. I'm thinking of my first capers. I show up to my first Indiana Cave Capers, and Greg McNamara sat down and hung out with me for like an hour at the open jam. Now, he may have had a few beers, I don't know, but he's like, I remember seeing you at the meeting, and, you know, said, just wanted to say hi, and, you know, sat and talked to me. And that meant a lot, and it means a lot when people show an interest and want you to be involved.
Exactly.
It's a big deal.
He's a good example.
It feels good, too. Any commentary on how the NSS is being operated now?
Do I feel like the way it's going now? Yes, because I just came back from the Montana Convention, and for me, I know lots of people, and it's great talking to them, people from all across the country, which I think is important from the aspect. I like the way things are going. We're all concerned about membership, And
but that seems like something that's always a concern. It was probably a concern when you were president. It's probably was a concern before then.
Well, when I was president, there were 12,000, over 12,000 members.
Active members?
Yeah, and then it's gone downhill since.
Gotcha.
So I must have done something wrong.
I'm sure it was all your fault.
No, yeah. Well, actually, there's two things that hurt us. One was winds, because you would go to a grotto meeting and you'd show some slides of some nice formations and say, this is a map, maybe, and say, this is a great cave, but we can't go to it because, you know, winds is a problem.
Yeah.
And that is starting to clear up, you know, that problem.
White noise syndrome.
A new guy shows up. What's he going to do if he can't go caving? He didn't come to watch slides.
I came in right when white nose syndrome was hitting. I mean, it was just before it came to Indiana, but I came right as it was hitting and everyone was worried about it. But luckily for me, I'm one of those people who is content to go back to the same caves over and over and over again. So for someone like me, it's not as big of a deal, especially in Indiana where we've got the IKC and a number of private own caves that are caver friendly and so I'm perfectly fine. But for the people who like to go to all different caves or like to maybe go to a cave, check it off the list, go to the next one, it's not so great for them.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed going back to the same caves. I would be unable to tell you how many times I've been to Buckner's or Sullivan's or Wayne's.
Yeah.
But I've enjoyed all those trips. You know, it's just fun to do them. And it's fun to take new people along or some of my friends that hadn't seen that cave. Going back to caves is not a problem. I will say this. We always tried to look for new stuff. When we went to Mexico, I mean, we spent the time looking for new stuff because we could have done the known stuff, which kind of we did in Golden Drinas, for example, and some of those. But we also spent a lot of time looking for new stuff. And I would say that I was familiar with most of the caves, known caves in Indiana, you know, back in that day when I was active. Since then, you guys have discovered some new caves. I guess I better check them out.
We got quite a list now. final question, and I appreciate your time, and it's been such a joy to have you. Would you say you have a favorite cave or a few favorite caves?
You know, that's a difficult
question. It's probably
hard
to pick a favorite, right?
I've listened to some of the podcasts, and you always ask that question. I thought, how would I answer that?
How could I possibly? Well, you don't have to. That's the thing is, you know, you don't have to pick your favorite children. No one's asking you to do that.
Right.
And if it comes down to that, I don't want you to even answer. But if you do have one.
Well, I guess if I were talking about favorite caver caves, that means enjoying the climbing, the crawling and stuff. In terms of horizontal, I would have a tough time picking between Wayne and Sullivan and Buckner's.
Oh, you see, those are my favorite.
Yeah. Well,
we should go. Yeah. You want to go? Let's go right now.
All right. If I had to pick a pit in Indiana, I would pick Jug Hole.
Oh,
that is such a neat pit.
I have heard so many wonderful things. I've never been myself, but man, yeah.
I was fortunate enough when I first started caving to find the cave, and I knew the family that owned it.
Yeah.
And then they had a son and a daughter, and I knew them. And so I got three generations of owners of that cave that I've dealt with.
Yeah,
and again, cave owner relations, if you're nice and you do it right and respectful, you can build those relationships and then you can go back to those caves.
Yeah.
Even when sometimes they were closed to others, but they would let me in. I had someone I won't name, but said they went to this Jug Hole and they said to the owner, well, could we go in the cave? And the guy said, no. He said, well, Bill Tozer said we could.
Great.
I didn't say that. But they were using that. He said, well, get out of here.
Did he bring it up to you after that? Did you tell somebody they could come to my cave?
He told me that, yes. I said, well, I forget how I sidestepped that one.
Well, good. At least you did. Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming on. You, ever since I heard about you, I thought, there's a dream guest, and I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you. I hope it's enjoyable to all that listen.
had such a great time with Bill. Thanks for coming by, Bill. And thanks to Keith Dunlap for bringing him straight from the airport and hanging out in there while we did that. And thanks to Keith Dunlap in general for being a caving boss. Thanks for listening to the Caving Podcast. Support us by supporting our sponsors, Swago at swagogear.com, Organic Robot on Etsy. Support me directly on Patreon at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. All that cash, and there's not much of it, but it all goes right back into cave conservation. I really, really appreciate it. It's a lot of work to put out this podcast every month, and if you kick some bucks my way, I couldn't thank you enough. Or, look, I'm doing this because I want to support caving. So if you want, you can support caving by making an extra donation to your local grotto. Your local grotto probably wants to do stuff. Like maybe our grotto bought a new projector this year. That costs money. If your grotto wants to put on an event, that costs money. These things cost money. So donate to your grotto, maybe donate to the NSS. And if you do that, thank you for that. We good? Everything covered? Hope so. Hey, stay safe out there. Have fun. Get as muddy as you possibly can. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.